posted on what's going on outside. We're heading up to the roof." As Harris walked back into the kitchen, he pointed to the ladder on the far wall and said, "Reavers, get up on the roof and test the strobe, and make sure you check for wires on that hatch before you open it." Reavers climbed the short ladder and looked at the edges of the square hatch that led to the flat roof. After he was sure there were no booby traps, he opened the hatch and climbed onto the roof. Harris, in the meantime, opened the back door just in time to greet his two men who were climbing the rickety stairs from the alley. Pointing to the front and back stairways, Harris said, "Booby trap both of them." Then he spun and went back toward the bedroom, saying, "Bravo 6, this is Whiskey 5. We are ready for pickup. What's your ETA? Over." The reply from the helicopters came back, "We are 7-2 seconds out. I repeat, 7-2 seconds out. Over." Harris checked his watch. They were within 15 seconds of their planned extraction time. "Slick, what's going on outside?" Down the street, Wicker rubbed the trigger guard of his rifle while he scanned the dark street with his night vision scope.
"Everything is quiet so far."
Back in the bedroom, Rapp had turned his attention to cuffing and gagging Harut. Harris came through the doorway as he was finishing up.
"Mitch, let's go. The chopper is on its way in."
"Roger."
Rapp stuck a sheaf of documents in his waistband and threw Harut over his shoulder. He bounced the old man twice until he had him in the right position. Then he started for the ladder. As Rapp started to climb, he heard the first sign of trouble come over his earpiece. Chapter 4. Bandar Abbas, Iran. From atop his perch down the street, Wicker was keeping a careful eye on the street and humming a Bob Marley tune to himself. Peering through his optic green night vision scope, he kept his breathing shallow and smooth. Suddenly, the door from the downstairs apartment opened, and a man wearing a pair of underpants appeared with an AK-47 gripped in his hands.
"Harry," the sniper spoke into his mic, "you've got company. The guy from the downstairs apartment just came outside."
Wicker watched through his scope as the man walked over to the slumped guard and shook his shoulder. The dead guard rolled from the chair to the ground, and the man stepped back quickly, bringing his AK-47 up to the firing position. Wicker didn't have time to think. From the moment the man had stepped outside, his head had never left the crosshairs of the scope. The seal squeezed the trigger of his rifle, the suppressor at the end of the barrel hissed with the expulsion of gases, and the bullet was away. The heavy round hit the man in the side of the head and propelled him to the ground, his body tensing as it was thrown and his index finger compressing on the trigger of the AK-47. A two-round burst of the loud rifle broke the pre-dawn silence.
"Tango down," stated a calm Wicker as he began a sweep for other targets.
Harris was standing under Rapp, making sure he got up the ladder, when he heard what he instantly knew to be the distinctive sound of an AK-47 firing. There was a split-second pause, and then everybody kicked it into high gear. Harris stepped away from the ladder and listened as Wicker gave him an update. When he had heard enough, he yelled at Jordan and Tony, "Are you two almost done?" Without looking up, Tony, the smaller of the two, said, "We'll be right with you." Harris pulled the mic back down.
"Reavers, any sign of our bird?"
Reavers had crawled to the edge of the roof to see what was happening on the street. He was looking down at the two dead bodies beneath him when his boss asked about the choppers. He looked up and scanned the horizon. The helicopters were nowhere in sight.
"That's a negative, Harry," replied Reavers.
"Is the strobe up and running?" asked Harris.
The strobe Harris was referring to was an infrared strobe light that was invisible to the naked eye, but glaringly visible to anyone wearing night vision goggles. From his perch down the block, Wicker did a quick check with his night vision scope and noted the flashing light atop the house.
"The strobe is active."
Harris looked at his watch and turned back to his two men booby-trapping the stairs.
"That's it. Everyone on the roof. Let's go."
The two men connected one last grenade and then scooted up the ladder. Harris followed them up and rolled onto the dirty flat roof. With his MP-10 in one hand, he closed the hatch. Spinning to check where his men were, the commander grabbed his night vision binoculars and looked to the northwest, scanning the sky for the choppers. As he searched the horizon, he heard Wicker call,
"More tangos on the move."
Wickers peered through his scope as two men and then a third appeared from the house across the street. All three were armed. Wicker maneuvered the scope and said,
"Everybody stay down. I can handle it."
As the first man approached the bodies of the dead men on the street, Wicker centered in on the side of his head and squeezed off a round. He slid the Galil to the left just a touch and framed up the second man, who was now standing in shock while he watched the man in front of him crumple to the ground. Wicker squeezed the trigger again and moved on. The third man was backpedaling for the door, waving his arms and screaming. He never made it. Harris dropped to his belly and quickly crawled to the edge of the flat roof. With his MP-10 up and ready, he looked over the edge at the bodies in the street. The SEALs were already deployed around the perimeter of the roof, two covering the alley and two covering the front. Rapp kneeled over the unconscious body of Harut and searched the sky for the helicopters.
"Boys," barked Harris, "shoot anything that moves."
The co-pilot of the Pavlo spotted the strobes when they were about a mile from the beach and alerted the rest of the crew. They had been directed to hit the northern strobe first. The Pavlo alerted the pilots of the Pavehawk, which was flying in formation at just under 150 miles per hour and hugging the deck. Simultaneously, the two helicopters broke formation. The larger Pavlo banked to the left and began to slow, while the agile Pavehawk broke to the right and began a full-speed run to the south. Right about the time Harris detected the noise of the incoming helicopters, the night sky blew open. A sustained burst of machine gun fire erupted from the building across the street. All but two of the 20-some rounds flew wildly over their heads. The two that hit the lip at the edge of the roof sent chunks of clay flying. Lying on his side, Harris said,
"Bravo 6, this is Whiskey 5. We are under fire. I repeat, under fire. The LZ is hot."
"Roger that, Whiskey 5," came the reply from the Pavlo. "Where is the fire coming from?"
"Directly across the street to our west."
"Roger, Whiskey 5. We have your position marked, and we'll be on top of you in about 20 seconds. Harris stayed flat on the roof. Another burst of machine gun fire rang out with more of the rounds crashing into the side of the roof, and then a second and a third gun joined in.
"Slick," the commander called out over the radio, "can you get these guys off my ass?"
"That's a negative, Harry. The angle is wrong."
Harris rolled onto his back as shouts were heard from below and another volley of bullets rang out.
"Ravers," yelled Harris, "I'll draw their fire and you bag 'em."
While lying on his back, Harris held his MP-10 over the edge and squeezed off four bursts at the house across the street. A second later, Reavers popped up, saw a muzzle flash in the second-story window, and zipped the target with three shots to the chest. Reavers quickly ducked back down as a flurry of return fire rang out. Wicker chimed in from his spot down the street.
"I think we stuck our hand in the hornet's nest."
More targets appeared, and Wicker went to work. The Pavlo came in much slower than a Hollywood director would have liked, but these big flying buses didn't stop on a dime. The roar of its powerful 3,900-horsepower turbine engines and churning rotors was deafening. As soon as he had targets in sight, the starboard gunner opened up with his 7.62mm minigun, hosing down the building across the street. The Pavlo stopped just on the other side of the strobe, but did not touch down. Within seconds of coming to a stop, the smaller Pavehawk appeared from the south and passed directly overhead, her guns blazing. Rapp grabbed Harut, threw him over his shoulder, and ran up the ramp of the Pavlo. Harris crouched at the foot of the ramp and picked up the strobe. He counted each of his men by slapping them on the ass as they ran up the ramp. When they were all in, Harris bounded into the chopper and gave the tail gunner a thumbs up. 1 second later, The helicopter rose 10 feet and began lumbering above the rooftops, all three gunners laying down suppressive fire as they moved out. Wicker continued to search for targets right up to the last second, but there were none to be found. The miniguns from the helicopters had cleared the street. As the Pavlo neared his position, the sniper saw the escort come screaming down the street for another pass. Wicker grabbed his gear, and as the ramp of the Pavlo neared, he jumped up and into the back of the cargo area. The second the pilots heard the last man was on board, they twisted the throttles to the stops and headed for sea. 20 excruciating seconds later, they were feet wet, hugging the water of the gulf, the Pave Hawk back in formation, heading for home. Washington, D.C., midnight. The plush room was located on the southwest corner of the 10th floor. It was one of the Washington Hotel's finest rooms. A faint gray light from the street below spilled through the windows and reflected off the white ceilings and walls. The sole occupant stood in front of an ornate mirror and stared at his reflection, his fingers gently probing the tender areas around his eyes and then his jaw. He was a handsome man, strikingly so. Even more so since the surgical changes had been made. The more rugged features had been smoothed and refined. He had been looking at this new face for almost a month and had yet to grow accustomed to it. Pulling the cigarette from his mouth, he turned his head to the right and studied his profile. The red scar tissue had healed, but was still sensitive in the areas where the skin was thin. The cheeks were more sallow, partially from the surgery, but also because he had lost 20 pounds. He was pleased with the results. They were not perfect, but they would be good enough. Exhaling a cloud of smoke, he stepped away from the mirror and turned. Through the haze of smoke, he looked out the large window at the city before him. His posture was erect. His dark skin and short black hair stood out starkly against the handmade white dress shirt he was wearing. To his left, the stoic Washington Monument jutted into the night sky, marking the center of the National Mall. Beyond that, the curved dome of the Jefferson Memorial shone just above the trees, while further to the west, marking the end of the mall, were the beautiful alabaster pillars of the Lincoln Memorial, and directly across the street lay the expansive Treasury Department. None of this, however, interested him. What did sat just on the other side of the Treasury Department. He inhaled, and then extracted the cigarette with a slow, even motion, letting his hand and the cigarette come to rest at his side. As the dark-eyed man took in the historic landscape, the corners of his mouth turned upward ever so slightly. It was an ominous smile. Rafik Aziz hated everything before him with more passion than any American could ever understand. The monuments and buildings before him were all symbols of America's imperialism, greed, corruption, and arrogance, the very things that had corrupted his homeland and pitted brother against brother. There were even those who were talking about peace with Israel, the Zionists, who, with the aid of the mighty America, had plunged his Beirut into a hell on earth. It was time again, time for another revolution. It was time to ignite the jihad. Chapter 5. Washington, D.C., 6:55 a.m. The majority of the United States Secret Service's 5,000-plus agents were assigned to field offices around the country and focused their attention on catching counterfeiters. But the better-known role of the agency was that of protecting politicians, and, more specifically, the President of the United States. The Secret Service's presidential detail carried a roster of approximately 200 special agents at any given time, and their positions were arguably the most competitive and sought-after jobs in all of law enforcement. Secret Service agent Ellen Morton was one of the lucky few. Morton walked through the executive mansion and stopped at the details down room located on the ground floor of the White House. The tiny, cramped room was officially designated staircase, the name derived from the room's location, which was underneath the stairs that led to the first family's private residence on the second and third floors of the mansion. Morton poked his head through the open doorway.
"Morning, Ted. How'd the night go?"
The agent leaned back and clasped his hands behind his head. With a yawn, he gave his one-word answer.
"Quiet."
In order to give the first family a certain amount of privacy, the Secret Service did not venture up to the second and third floors of the mansion unless called. They instead relied on a series of pressure pads installed in various areas beneath the carpet to track the president's whereabouts on the floors above.
"Is he up?"
asked Morton.
"Yep, the steward phoned down and said he's putting on a suit."
On most mornings, President Hayes went straight over to the West Wing at 7, but there were times, usually after he had been traveling, when he liked to work out in his private gym on the third floor and then walk over to the office at around 8. The agents on the detail usually had no idea what to expect until the Navy steward called down to tell them the president was wearing either workout clothes or a suit. The security panel on the wall of staircase beeped, and a red light blinked, announcing that the president's elevator was moving. Morton nodded to the other agent and raised her hand mic to her mouth.
"Horsepower from Morton. Woody is on his way down."
Horsepower was the designation for the Presidential Detail's command post located under the Oval Office. The Presidential Detail's chief concern and focus was the president, while the actual security of the White House compound was handled by the Secret Service's Uniformed Division. There was a second command post located on the fifth floor of the Executive Office Building across the street from the White House that coordinated and monitored the two groups' activities. It was called the Joint Operations Center, or JOC, and was built in the wake of an unauthorized attempted landing on the South Lawn by a single-engine airplane in 1994. JOC monitored the movements of both the uniformed officers and the special agents. The doors to the elevator opened, and President Hayes emerged wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and paisley tie. The president looked at the familiar face before him and said,
"Good morning, Helen."
"Good morning, sir."
Morton moved out ahead of the president, walking down the long hall that led to the palm room. As shift leader, or whip, of the day detail, it was her responsibility to coordinate the movement of the president from the mansion to the West Wing. They entered the palm room, and Morton spoke into her hand mic.
"Horsepower from Morton. Woody is approaching the colonnade."
As Morton reached the double glass doors, she nodded to the agent on the other side and watched him move out ahead. Morton held the door for President Hayes, and then the two of them stepped out onto the fieldstone walkway of the colonnade. The president stopped and took in the bright spring morning. Feeling the warm morning sun on his face for the first time in weeks, he closed his eyes and smiled. After a long moment, he drew in a deep breath. Then, opening his eyes, he looked out at the mist-covered grass of the South Lawn. Ellen Morton stood silently behind him, her hands clasped in front of her. Without turning, President Hayes said,
"Beautiful morning, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is, sir,"
Morton grinned to herself. She was still not used to Hayes's private persona. With all of the security and pomp and circumstance, it was easy to forget that he was a real person. A husband, a father, and a grandfather.
"It makes me wish I was on the golf course."
Hayes shook his head.
"Well, it's off to the daily grind."
With that, he started down the stone walkway. Morton followed a step behind as they headed past Jefferson's pillars. When they reached the doors that led to the West Wing by the White House press room, they took a left, continuing past the French doors of the cabinet room, and then around to the right. As they rounded the corner, Morton looked ahead at the agent by the Oval Office. He was getting ready to insert a key into the door. Over her earpiece, Morton heard the agent say,
"Horsepower from Cali. Authorized brake on the Oval Colonnade door."
The agent then stuck the key in the door and opened it, holding it for the president and Morton. The president took a final look at the blooming flowers in the rose garden as he walked, and then greeted the agent holding the door.
Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, sir. President Hayes walked into the Oval Office first, and Morton second. The president continued straight ahead, passing his desk, and then going through the short hallway that led to his private study, bathroom, and dining room. Morton turned to the right and opened the door that led to the secretary's office. She closed it behind her and said into her mic, "Horsepower from Morton. Woody is in the Oval." On the other side of the Oval Office, in the main hallway, two Secret Service agents from the presidential detail relieved two uniformed officers and took up posts outside the door to the president's dining room and the main door to the Oval Office. Inside the president's private dining room, Hayes took off his suit coat and handed it to a small Filipino man dressed in a white waistcoat and black pants.
"Good morning, Carl."
"Good morning, Mr. President," answered the Navy steward.
Carl closed the door and took the president's jacket, hanging it on an antique wooden valet in the corner. A circular oak table for four occupied the center of the room. Hayes sat at the seat closest to the Oval Office and pulled in his chair. Folded and laid in front of him were copies of the Washington Post, the Washington Times, the New York Times, and USA Today. The same four papers were laid out in the same order every day, Monday through Friday. The president began perusing the headlines. The steward approached and placed a cup of black coffee next to the copy of the Times.
"What would you like for breakfast this morning, Mr. President?"
Without looking up, President Hayes reached out for the cup of coffee.
"How about a half a grapefruit to start with, please?"
The steward nodded and retreated into the pantry while the president began reading an article in the Post. Before the grapefruit was served, there was a knock on the door. The Navy steward opened it and greeted the two visitors. Bill Schwartz, the president's national security advisor, entered the room with Dr. Irene Kennedy from the CIA. The lanky national security advisor greeted the president's steward.
"Good morning, Carl."
"Good morning, Mr. Schwartz. What would you like to drink?"
"My usual, please."
"And for the lady?"
"Just a cup of regular, please," replied Kennedy.
Schwartz maneuvered his thin frame across the room and sat in the spot directly across from Hayes. Kennedy placed her briefcase on the floor and sat immediately to the president's right. The president looked up at his national security advisor and asked,
"How was your trip?"
Schwartz had just returned from Brussels, where he had attended 3 days of meetings on the further expansion of NATO. Schwartz removed his small, silver-rimmed glasses and began to clean the lenses with his tie. It was slow, boring, and painful.
"It always is with NATO." President Hayes took a sip of coffee and placed the mug back on the table. "The only organization that's worse is the UN.
"That is true." Schwartz nodded his head slowly and watched Carl place a mug of coffee in front of Kennedy and then himself. Next, the steward gave the president his halved grapefruit and put the other half in front of Schwartz, saying,
"Eat this. I'm going to get you some pancakes, too, and see if we can put some meat on your bones."
The steward then winked at the president. Carl had worked in the White House for more than 20 years and was an expert at ribbing even the most powerful of Washington insiders. With his hands clasped in front of his waist, Carl bent forward and, in a much more friendly tone than the one he had used with the National Security Advisor, asked,
"May I get you anything to eat, miss?"
"No, thank you. I'm fine."
Kennedy wrapped her hands around the warm coffee mug. The steward turned to President Hayes.
"If you need anything more, please ring."
"I will. Thank you, Carl."
The president watched the steward leave and then leaned back. Looking to Kennedy, he said,
"I got your message last night. I'm glad to hear everything went well."
"Yes, so far so good."
Kennedy brought her coffee up to her lips and took a small sip.
"Bill, how much do you know about last night's activities?" asked the president.
Schwartz dumped a teaspoon of sugar onto his moist grapefruit and said,
"Irene filled me in on the basics when I got in last night."
"What time was that?"
"Just after midnight."
The president looked to Kennedy.
"Have we discovered anything yet?"
"Our man and Harut left Saudi Arabia around 2 this morning.
They were supposed to touch down at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany.
Kennedy looked at her watch and did the calculation.
In about 30 minutes. There they will be met by a team of specialists who will board the plane and start to interrogate Harut while airborne for Andrews.
The president thought about asking her what she meant by the term specialists, but decided he was better off not knowing. When can we expect some answers?
It's hard to tell. Sometimes the information is extracted easily, but the drugs don't always work the same way on everyone. There are certain precautions we need to take to make sure he isn't lying.
Kennedy paused. Stansfield had told her from day one to always be on the cautious side, especially when dealing with politicians. She looked to NSA Schwartz and then back to President Hayes.
We need to be thorough.
Hayes stacked the newspapers one on top of another off to the side.
Are we talking hours or days?
We will start getting information out of him within minutes. Depending on what he knows and what kind of health he's in, we should have some answers within an hour. But let me caution you that it will take weeks to fully interrogate and debrief him.
But our priority here is to find out if, when, and where they are planning this attack in Washington.
Yes,
Kennedy nodded. Hayes looked to Schwartz, whose job it was to coordinate the efforts of all the intelligence agencies.
I want this to receive top priority, and I want a full briefing on the interrogation.
Kennedy nodded.
Yes, Mr. President.
Washington, D.C. 2 miles east of the White House, a green and white truck backed up to the entrance of a dilapidated warehouse and stopped. Plastered in large white letters across the green side of the cargo area were the words, White Knight Linen Service. 2 men in blue coveralls came out of the warehouse and hefted the rusting garage door up, its casters screeching as metal scraped on metal. The driver put the truck in reverse, and the 2 men guided the boxy vehicle through the narrow door with hand signals. When all of the truck was inside, the door was closed. A hazy light filtered through the dirty windows near the roof of the building. 4 men approached the rear of the truck, and a ramp was secured to the fender. The men began to unload the truck's canvas laundry baskets and boxes of fresh linen. After about 5 minutes, the vehicle's cargo area was empty. From an elevated glass office, a man in green fatigues appeared. His closely trimmed beard grew from the top of his cheekbones down into his collar, and his hands and forearms were covered with thick black hair. In contrast to the rest of his body, the top of his head was bald, a shiny bronze oasis of smooth skin bordered by a horseshoe of black hair. Although short in stature, Muammar Benghazi was obviously strong. Gripping the metal railing with his thick fingers, Benghazi watched his men work. They had come too far to make any mistakes now. Everything had to be done perfectly from this point forward. They had been given a summary from their benefactor that detailed the exact layout of the building. Benghazi was told the report had been compiled by the KGB some 20 years earlier. More recently, one of his men had got inside the building and given them a more up-to-date summary. Benghazi whistled, and his men looked up. From his perch, he pointed to 3 objects sitting under canvas tarps located in the far corner of the warehouse. He watched his men walk over and yank the tarps back. Underneath sat 3 Kawasaki all-terrain vehicles painted in a drab tan and green camouflage pattern. The small vehicles were used by hunters for their maneuverability and power. Around the back of each vehicle, a U-shaped cargo rack was attached. The cargo racks were stacked with metal trunks that were tightly secured by black bungee cords. One by one, the men started the ATVs. The musty smell of the warehouse was soon replaced with that of gas and oil. A small trailer, also loaded with metal boxes, was hooked to one of the ATVs and backed up the ramp and into the truck. The other 2 ATVs followed and were backed in tightly. Benghazi walked down the metal stairs from the office to the floor of the warehouse. He was surprisingly light on his feet for a man of such girth. He approached a bright yellow forklift, climbed into the driver's seat, and started the engine.
After the vehicle warmed up, Benghazi backed it carefully up the ramp and into the back of the truck. The forklift was missing its two metal forks that were normally positioned in front. When Benghazi had the heavy piece of machinery exactly where he wanted it, he turned it off and climbed down. He jumped from the tailgate and moved off to the side. For the next 5 minutes, he watched his men reload enough of the truck's original cargo to conceal the forklift and ATVs. He walked from one side of the tailgate to the other, attempting to peer around and over the boxes and baskets. Satisfied with the job, he nodded to his men and checked his watch. They were on schedule. Ramstein Air Force Base, Germany. There was a slight jolt followed by a hydraulic whine. Mitch Rapp was yanked from his deep sleep and jerked forward in his seat, simultaneously reaching for his Beretta and looking to his left. He breathed a sigh of relief, and slowly his hand released the grip of his gun. Harut was still there, hands and feet cuffed, with a black hood over his head, lying strapped to the leather couch of the Learjet. His turban and robe had been replaced with a green flight suit. Rapp rubbed his eyes and looked out the small window on his right, quickly realizing that the bump that had awakened him was the landing gear locking into position. They were almost level with the German countryside. A second later, they cleared the trees, and the concrete runway was beneath them. The green fields were replaced by a rank of gray hangars and planes. First, a row of large C-130s, then several flights of F-16s, and then finally they touched down. Rapp continued to rub his eyes with clenched fists. He felt almost as if he had been drugged. The past 3 nights had been marked by a total of 6 hours of sleep. Rapp checked his watch and estimated that he had been out for almost 4 hours. It was a good start, but he wouldn't mind getting a couple more hours of shut-eye as they crossed the Atlantic. There was no telling how quickly he would have to go out in the field again. The plane taxied off the main runway and came to a stop next to a fuel truck and a blue van with blacked-out windows. Rapp unbuckled his seatbelt and got up. His appearance had changed since leaving Bandar Abbas. The unkempt black and gray beard was gone, replaced by a cleanly shaven face. With the beard gone, a scar was now visible on Rapp's left cheek. It was narrow, less than an eighth of an inch, and it started by his ear and ran straight down to his jaw, the pink scar tissue offset by his bronze skin. The doctors at Johns Hopkins had done a good job minimizing the knife mark. At first, it was almost half an inch wide, but after the plastic surgeons were done, there was only a thin line. This scar, more than any of his others, was a daily reminder to Rapp that what he was doing was very real and very dangerous. A streak of gray could still be found in his long, thick hair, but most of it had been washed out during the 15-minute shower he took after the helicopters had landed in Saudi Arabia. Rapp had shared a quick Miller Lite with Harris and his men, and then headed for the showers to wash a week's worth of dirt and grime from his body. He stood under the hot water and scrubbed every inch of his filthy skin 3 times. When he had finished washing the dirt and smell away, he stood under the hot water for another 5 minutes and savored a second Miller Lite. By the time he was clean and dressed, the Learjet was ready. Rapp went back into the room where Harris and his marauders were already into their second case of beer and found Harut changed into a green flight suit, medicated, and lying on a cot in the corner. Congratulations were exchanged once again, and then Rapp threw Harut over his shoulder and headed for the flight line. Now on the ground in Germany, Rapp looked down at Harut and yawned. Rapp would have just as soon put a bullet in Harut's head back in Iran, but if it meant finding out where Aziz was, the young American was willing to do almost anything. Rapp walked to the front of the jet with his head tilted to the side. When he reached the door, he grabbed the handle and twisted it clockwise. There was a slight hiss as the pressurized air escaped. Rapp let the door out and eased it toward the ground. Despite the overcast morning sky, he still had to shield his eyes from the light.
His lean biceps bulged under the fabric of the black polo shirt he was wearing, and a brown leather shoulder holster held his Beretta securely to his side. The door of the blue van opened, and a woman stepped onto the tarmac. Two men followed her. It wasn't often that Rapp felt uneasy, but as he watched Dr. Jane Hornig walk toward him, he found himself suddenly wishing he were elsewhere. Hornig, in her mid-40s, scurried toward the jet with one hand clutching the lapels of her blue blazer and the other holding her metallic briefcase. As Rapp watched her approach, he couldn't help but think of the scene from The Wizard of Oz when the mean neighbor, who turns out to be the Wicked Witch of the West, shows up on her bike to take Toto away. The music was even playing in the back of his mind. Rapp was convinced that Hornig's face had seen neither sun nor makeup in over a decade. She had the classic demeanor of a scientist, disheveled and low maintenance. Clothes and appearance didn't matter to Hornig, only her work did. Standing just a touch over 5 feet tall, she still wore her hair in a bun and dressed as if she had never found her way out of the 60s. On the one occasion that Lieutenant Commander Harris had met Dr. Hornig, he had, in his typical smart-ass way, dubbed her Dr. Strangelove, after the hilariously abused character played by Peter Sellers in the 1964 Cold War spoof. Hornig, for all of her eerie qualities, was far more than just a psychologist. She also had advanced degrees in both biochemistry and neurology, and was considered the foremost expert in America on the history and evolution of human torture. She had an interesting business relationship with the CIA. Langley provided her with guinea pigs for her experimental drugs and techniques, and in return, she gave them what they wanted, information pulled from the deepest recesses of the human brain. This often included details that the subjects would not be able to remember on their own. Rapp had watched Hornig and her henchmen work on one occasion, and after about 10 minutes he decided he could wait for the Memorex version when they were done. As Hornig approached the foot of the stairs, she looked up and said, "Hello, Mr. Cruz." Very few people at Langley knew Rapp's real name. To them he was Mr. Cruz, a case officer who specialized in the Middle East. People in the intelligence business knew not to ask too many questions when dealing with field personnel. Indiscretion usually guaranteed an official reprimand from one superior. Rapp greeted the doctor and stepped back, allowing her room to enter. Hornig looked to the rear of the plane.
"How is he doing?"
"Fine. I gave him the exact doses you prescribed."
"Good."
The doctor set a silver ballistic briefcase on the nearest seat and turned to the door.
"These are my assistants, Sam and Matt."
Rapp looked at the two men and nodded. Both were carrying two larger silver ballistic briefcases. "There is a bedroom at the rear of the plane," Rapp pointed. "It's probably the best place to get set up." Hornig agreed, and she and her two assistants continued single file toward the rear of the jet. Rapp watched them move Harut into the bedroom and decided it would be a good time to get some fresh air. As he stepped down onto the tarmac, he felt the rare urge to smoke a cigarette. It was a nasty little habit he had picked up while working undercover, and from time to time he still found himself craving one. He looked to his left, where an airman was busy refueling the plane. Rapp almost made the stupid mistake of asking the man for a cigarette, but he saw the flammable insignia on the side of the green truck. Rapp stood awkwardly next to the plane and looked to his left and then right. The low gray skies and rows of sterile military hangars gave the morning a depressing and dirty feeling. Rapp sensed the oncoming downturn in his emotions and fought it. There was the tinge of self-pity, triggered by either the dreary surroundings or the arrival of Hornig, or probably both. These little mood swings had become more and more frequent over the last year. Rapp thought he knew what was causing them. When you spent as much time alone with your thoughts as he did, self-diagnosis became as normal as eating. He was nowhere near the pain and anguish that he had suffered almost a decade earlier. This wasn't like that. It was different. This was more like a warning that if he didn't do something,
he would be stuck on a certain path for the rest of his life, a barren path marked by loneliness. Before leaving on the most recent mission, he had talked to Kennedy about it. His parents were both gone, and although he still had friends outside of work and a brother in New York with whom he was very close, it wasn't as if he could pick up the phone and talk about his day at the office. He could talk about his computer consulting business all he wanted, but Langley was off limits. Officially, Rapp didn't even work for the CIA. He was what they like to refer to in the business as a private contractor. Rapp lived a life completely separate from the agency. With the help of Langley, he ran a computer consulting business on the side that just happened to do a fair amount of international business, which of course gave him the cover to travel. His only passion in life outside of work was competing in the annual Ironman competition in Hawaii, an event that the former All-American lacrosse player from Syracuse University had actually won once. During these dark, brooding moments, Rapp had wondered how screwed up his life was, or worse, how screwed up it might get. He would continually ask himself if it was normal to want with such determination to kill another human being. He knew this was the crux of his problem, and had once joked with Kennedy by saying, "Most people have lists of things they want to do before they get to a certain age, like go skydiving, travel to China, have a kid. Not me. At the top of my list of things to do before I turn 40 is kill Farah Harout and Rafiq Aziz. How healthy do you think that is?" Laughing and making jokes were all part of therapy for Rapp. Without humor, he would never make it. In his job, he needed to stay loose, or, like a watch wound too tight, he would explode. Rapp had studied it from every angle, and he believed that his position was both moral and just. The problem, however, lay in the fact that Rapp knew the hunt was destroying him. He was increasingly losing touch with that segment of society that was labeled normal. His friends from college were all married and having children, and for him there wasn't the hope of either on the horizon. He knew that to have a normal life, he would have to finish what he had set out to do. He could not have a family and continue to work for the CIA. The two would not mix. Rapp thought back to how nice his life had been just 10 years earlier, and to the weird twist of fate that had led him to this point in life, to this dreary military base in Germany. "No one ever said life would be easy," his father used to say. Rapp laughed at the thought of his father telling him to suck it up, as he had done countless times throughout Rapp's youth. It had gotten to the point where Rapp's father would say the three short words with a smile on his face. The short phrase had grown from words of criticism into words of encouragement. The roar of a jet sounded in the distance, and Rapp stepped away from the plane to search it out. Looking down the long runway, he saw a lone F-16 racing in the opposite direction, its single engine on afterburner glowing bright orange. The agile jet lifted into the air above the mirage of dancing runway heat and instantly retracted its landing gear. As the plane climbed, Rapp watched it gain speed. He followed it for a minute or two until it was a speck in the expansive gray morning sky. A second jet pulled onto the runway and screamed into the air, chasing after the first. Rapp gazed at the second jet and knew he was a possessed man. He would pursue Rafiq Aziz wherever he went, even if it led to his own destruction. The trick would be to catch Aziz before he himself reached the point of no return, and Rapp could sense that point nearing, hovering just over the horizon. Rapp watched the airman detach the fuel hose and climb into the truck. As the tanker pulled away from the Learjet, the plane's twin engines began turning. Rapp took one last look at the dreary scenery and climbed into the jet. As he pulled the door up and secured it, he smiled and whispered to himself his father's words of encouragement. Chapter 6. Washington, D.C., 8:05 a.m.
The tan, well-kept man was shown into the oak-paneled office of the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. The rotund and jovial Russ Piper stood from behind his desk and walked over to greet his wealthy visitor. Extending his hand, Piper said,
"Prince Kalib, it is a pleasure to finally meet you."
Rafiq Aziz extended his hand with the proper amount of aloofness and took Piper's hand in a light grip.
"How was your flight?" asked Piper.
Aziz looked around the room, gazing at the framed photos hanging on the paneled walls.
"Fine." Aziz planned to keep conversation to a minimum. The real Prince Kalib was a recluse, and the characteristic fit his needs perfectly.
"I understand you're en route to the Mayo Clinic to visit your father."
"That is correct," Aziz nodded.
"How is the Sultan doing?"
"He is fine."
Aziz extracted a gold cigarette case from his jacket pocket.
"The doctors at the Mayo Clinic are the best in the world."
Aziz lit the cigarette with a matching gold lighter, exhaled a cloud of smoke, and walked over to the window. Piper watched his guest light up with his mouth slightly agape, words of admonishment ready to spill forth. The chairman almost informed his royal guest that smoking was not allowed in the building, but after a moment he thought better of it. Piper ran his hands down his tie and checked to make sure it was straight.
"Yes, we've treated many of our own presidents there," added Piper, getting back to the conversation.
Aziz continued to look out the window at the large rotunda of the capital. Then, turning slowly, he said,
"I assume you had no difficulty in arranging our meeting."
"No difficulty whatsoever," Piper said proudly. "The president and I are very close."
"Good."
While holding his cigarette with one hand, he reached into his jacket and pulled out a long blue check.
"As per your instructions, I had this written to your party through one of my American corporations."
Piper grabbed the check with both hands and looked at the all-important box on the right side. The chairman of the Democratic National Committee smiled at the large number.
"This is greatly appreciated, Your Highness."
Aziz nodded benevolently.
"I can promise you that I will do everything within my power to help your country obtain the proper defensive weapons that you seek."
"Kingdom," corrected Aziz.
"Yes, kingdom."
Piper nervously rubbed his hands together.
"My apologies."
Looking at his watch, he said,
"Well, we should probably get going. I have a limousine waiting downstairs to take us to the White House. We don't want to be late to see the president."
"No, we don't," Aziz grinned. "I've been looking forward to this day for a long time."
The White House. President Hayes sat behind his desk in the Oval Office. His suit coat was draped over the back of his high-backed leather chair, and in front of him was a photocopy of his daily schedule. The schedule was typed, but his 9 a.m. meeting had been crossed out, and his chief of staff had written something in the margin. The president squinted at the handwriting and tried to make out the small cursive letters. Hayes picked up the paper and decided it wasn't his eyes that needed help, it was his chief of staff's handwriting. Without knocking, Valerie Jones entered the Oval Office through the main hallway. She had a stack of folders under her left arm and a leather day timer in her right hand.
"Good morning, Robert."
Jones continued across the room and set the folders on the left side of the president's desk. Hayes held up the schedule for her to see.
"What's this you wrote here in the margin?"
Without having to look, Jones said,
"Last minute change. Prince Kalib from Oman is on his way through town to see his father at the Mayo Clinic."
Hayes tapped his capped Waterman pen against his cheek while frowning. "And?"
"And?"
Jones put her hands on her hips and smiled.
"You don't want to know. Just take my word for it. It'll be a worthwhile meeting."
President Hayes nodded slowly. Leaning back in his chair, he studied Jones's outfit for a split second. She was wearing a yellow silk blouse that was almost dark enough to pass for gold. Hayes thought the bright blouse combined with the black skirt and scarf made her look like a bumblebee. Having a wife and two grown daughters of his own, he was smart enough to keep this opinion to himself.
What else do you have for me?
The First Lady left Andrews about 15 minutes ago and will be on the ground in Columbus just before 10. Which reminds me.
Joan stepped to her left and placed both hands on the surface of the desk.
I still think you should go to Columbus. You can fly out tomorrow afternoon and make the party with no trouble at all.
The president's fifth grandchild and his namesake, Robert Xavier Hayes, was celebrating his first birthday tomorrow. Hayes shook his head. I'm going to see little Robert in 2 weeks, and I'll celebrate his birthday then.
I think you should go tomorrow, persisted the chief of staff.
I'm not going. It costs a lot of money to fly everybody over there just for the evening.
Fine.
At the insistence of the First Lady, Jones had given it one more try. The chief of staff grabbed one of the folders she had brought and opened it.
I need your signature on about 30 documents. Some of them you'll want to glance over, and others you can just sign.
With a sigh, Hayes began working his way through the stack of papers. Washington, D.C. The white night linen truck pulled up to the cobblestone entrance of the underground parking garage at the Treasury Building. A uniformed Secret Service agent stepped out from his guard booth and smiled at the driver, saying,
How are you, Vinny?
Good, Tony. The driver stepped down from the cab.
You staying awake this morning?
Just barely.
The officer handed him a clipboard and asked, Did you watch the game last night?
Of course. I hate those stinking Yankees. I think I hate the Yankees more than the Red Sox.
Abu Hassan took the clipboard and signed his fake name, Vinnie Vitelli. Hassan had been working for the White Knight Linen Service for almost 8 months. White Knight was in the middle of its 4-year contract with the Treasury Department. Getting a job with the company had been easy, and passing the FBI background check had proved even easier. The only hard part was getting rid of the previous driver. The old driver had come down with an incapacitating case of food poisoning the day after he had dined with Hassan about 5 months ago. Hassan had conveniently stepped in and covered the man's route until he was better. 2 weeks after that, when the man was killed in an attempted robbery near his apartment, Hassan was right there to step in and take over the dead man's route. Hassan handed the clipboard back to the Secret Service officer.
I have 2 extra tickets to the Indians-Orioles game on Saturday, if you want them.
The officer grabbed the clipboard.
That would be great. My kid would love it.
Hassan smiled.
Good.
He had worked hard to get to know as many of the uniformed officers as he could. It was crucial to the mission. If they couldn't get the truck into the garage without being inspected, the entire plan would fail.
Are you working tomorrow afternoon?
Asked Hassan as he turned to go back to the truck.
Yep.
Good. I'll bring them by.
Thanks, Vinny. I appreciate it.
The guard tugged on the brim of his cap. Hassan climbed back up into the cab and released the emergency brake. As the heavy steel gates opened, the terrorist looked to his left at the fence that separated the White House from the Treasury Department. He grinned and bit down hard on his tongue, fighting back the urge to smile as he looked beyond the gate at the most famous house in the world. Hassan put the truck in gear, drove through the gate, and down the ramp. Washington, D.C. The taxicab continued south down Pennsylvania Avenue and crossed the intersection at 17th Street. The driver pulled in between 2 large circular concrete planters, turned to the left, and stopped. Only a block away from the White House, the road ahead was closed to all motor traffic. Anna Reilly sat in the back seat and looked out at the barricades the Secret Service had constructed in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. A row of concrete planters extended from each curb and stopped, leaving just enough room for a guard booth and a huge steel barricade with the word STOP emblazoned in white against a red background. The steel barricade was hydraulic and could be lowered to allow authorized vehicles to proceed to the next checkpoint. Reilly paid the driver and got out of the back seat. She had a large black bag over one shoulder and a smaller purse over the other. While she adjusted the large bag, she looked up at the gothic-looking executive office building and frowned. Reilly tried to decide if she liked the building or not. She studied the ominous structure and brushed her shoulder-length, dark brown hair back behind both ears. It was beautiful in its craftsmanship, but seemed out of place among the rest of Washington's architecture. The young reporter was wearing pleated black dress pants and a matching jacket that were offset by a white silk blouse. Wanting to savor every moment of this achievement, she took in the whole scene. Her skin was aglow in the early morning sunlight, and really beamed with pride as she approached the guard booth.
"Hello, I'm the new White House correspondent for..."
The uniformed Secret Service officer behind the bulletproof glass pressed a button on his panel and said,
"Ma'am, I only check motor traffic at this gate. You may proceed down another block to the northwest gate where they can check you in to the White House."
Reilly thanked the guard and walked in between two of the planters. As she continued down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, she noticed the Blair House on her left, the president's unofficial residence when he could not stay at the White House because of construction or some other problem. Reilly continued walking, taking it all in. At the next block, she stopped at another guard booth, identical to the first. Anna Reilly proudly presented her credentials to the man behind the blue-hued bulletproof glass. She had finally made it to the big leagues after serving as a reporter and weekend anchor for the NBC affiliate in Chicago for the last 5 years. NBC had picked her to be their new White House correspondent. Reilly looked around while she waited for the guard to run her through his computer. On the other side of the fence, she could see all of the tripods and equipment that the networks left on the White House lawn for their live shots. Some were sitting under tarps, and others were just laid out and covered with morning dew. Reilly couldn't begin to count how many times she had imagined herself standing in that exact spot, giving the nation the inside story on what had just happened at the White House. Since her first journalism class at the University of Michigan 12 years earlier, she had dreamed of this day, covering the White House, the center of politics, important issues that affected world events. No more boring chit-chat about the weather, fronts coming off of Lake Michigan. Sports, weather, and murders were 99% of the broadcast in Chicago. Reilly smiled briefly as she thought of her life there. She would miss her brothers and parents dearly, but flights to Chicago were cheap and frequent. The uniformed Secret Service officer looked at Reilly through the glass and asked,
"First day on the job?"
Reilly smiled, showing a set of dimples.
"Yep."
The agent placed her ID and a badge in the metal trough under the glass and slid them to her. Through the speaker, he said,
"Please wear this badge at all times while in the compound. You may proceed down the street here," the guard pointed, "to that white awning on the left. They'll tell you where to go from there."
Reilly thanked the man, and she was buzzed through the first gate and then a second. She continued down West Executive Drive to the awning. As she stepped onto the curb, a limousine pulled up. Its back door opened, and she heard a familiar voice call her name. Reilly turned and saw Russ Piper, the former mayor of Chicago, struggling to get out of the back seat of the limo. Piper had one hand on the door and the other on the door frame. The majority of his weight was in his belly, so he had to draw himself to the very edge of the seat before he had the leverage to stand. Reilly, somewhat surprised, said,
"Russ."
She stepped forward and met Piper's hug. Piper squeezed her tight and then stepped away, still holding her by the shoulders.
"Dorothy just told me last night you were coming to town, but I had no idea it would be this fast."
Reilly's face twisted.
"I didn't even know I was coming until 2 days ago. How did your wife find out so fast?"
"My guess would be that your mother told her, which of course means half of Chicago knows by now that you're the new White House correspondent for NBC.
Piper gave her a big hug again.
"Congratulations, Anna. I know how hard you've worked for this. I think it's just fantastic."
He kissed her on the forehead. Reilly's mother was very active in Chicago Democratic politics, and her parents had been close friends with the Pipers for as long as she could remember. Piper released her again, and with a frown asked,
"When were you planning on calling us?"
"I just got in last night."
"Where are you staying?" Piper's brow furrowed. "I hope you're not staying at a hotel.
Dorothy will be really upset if you don't stay with us.
Anna tilted her head. Russ, I'm not on spring break.
She looked away from Piper as a second man stepped from the limo. She noted that he was probably a foreigner, and one with a lot of money, judging by the clothes he was wearing. Piper followed Reilly's gaze to his guest and said,
"Oh, I'm sorry. Prince Caleb, I would like you to meet a very good friend of mine, Miss